Good morning. It's Friday, June 26th. From HPR 2, it's The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Historic preservationists are working to protect the Hawaii Island site of a battle that changed Hawaiian life forever, the 1819 Battle of Kuamo'o. Keola Beamer will be on hand to tell us about the effort. And the Affordable Care Act has survived its most serious court challenge to date. But what does yesterday's decision mean for health care in Hawaii? We'll get a longtime court watcher's perspective.
And I'm Kathy Kozak. Little red fire ants. Their bite is much bigger than their size, and given the chance, they'd love to be taking over the islands. Find out what you can do to help. And it's time for an Aloha Friday musical celebration with Uncle Tom Moffat and the International Reggae Day Festival.
Conversation starts right after the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook and I'm here with Kathy Kozak. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. Lots of news out from the Supreme Court the last couple of days.
Keeping us very busy, isn't it? When they start issuing those decisions, history gets shaken up. That's clearly what's been happening the last couple of days.
Absolutely, and a lot of good news as far as I'm concerned.
We've got a discussion ahead about that very thing. But right now we're thinking about history and something vital is lost when historic sites are allowed to fall apart, and historic preservationists operate from an acute sense of their importance to future generations. The Battle of Kuamo'o in 1819 signaled a fundamental shift in the lives of Hawaiian with the abolition of the kapu system, as it offered an object lesson in reconciliation. The site is the focus of a combined preservation and restoration effort by Aloha Kuamo'o Aina and the Trust for Public Land. Keola Beamer is their spokesperson, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Keola.
Hey, good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, a lot of us in Hawaii know and admire your music, and it occurred to me as we're getting ready to talk about this that your music and your culture have obviously deeply intertwined.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be one without the other, would it?
Right. You know, so many beautiful things came to my life from music. I found my passion, my love, and I found my wife. I found my home. Everything sort of came down through the music. Such a blessing.
But it also gives you a platform, Keola, and that's the platform that we're concerned with today, because the site on the Kona Coast is important. Why?
Oh, absolutely. It's really tremendously important. You know, a lot of people don't realize that the last battle waged in Hawaii in December of 1819 was a battle for Hawaii's future.
Yeah.
There were two opposing factions. And one was Kamehameha II, Liholiho. His father had Kamehameha I had just died, leaving a power vacuum.
Yeah.
So the two cousins, Liholiho and Keiku Okalani, had a different vision. Each one had a different vision for Hawaii's future. The modernists, which were Liholihos, they wanted to abolish the kapu system and find a new way of operating in Hawaii. And Keiku Okalani and his wife, the Princess Manono, were traditionalists, and they wanted to keep the old ways of Hawaii. So it was these two parties met in battle, a very bloody and terrible campaign on this battlefield at Kuamo'o, in which Liholiho was victorious, and my ancestors, the Princess Manono and Keiku Okalani, were both killed. And it was a very poignant time as it came down to me again through the music, the chants, and my family. You know, it was very emotional kind of story where at her last breath, the Princess Manono uttered these words, Malama ko aloha, keep your love. She was talking about keep your love for Hawaii. And then she was felled finally by a musket ball and died next to her husband. And, you know, the sort of courage of that idea, that statement, went down through their followers, and those that survived were put in a stockade in Kona. And Liholiho, arriving the next day, he was actually at the battlefield. His battle chief was Kalanimoku. Yeah. So Liholiho arrived the next day and heard these fallen warriors chanting, Ko aloha, malama ko aloha, keep your love. And then he realized that, you know, these were his countrymen too, and he pardoned them.
That strikes me, Keola, as a really profound act of reconciliation because, you know, if you don't have that, you essentially have the ingredients of civil war, right?
Exactly, exactly right. And that's the beautiful message of Kuomo'o. Pardon me, my morning throat here.
Sure.
The message of Kuomo'o is one of eventually of reconciliation.
Yeah.
And we hope to take the, you know, when you're there, you just feel this tremendous gravitas of these fallen warriors. They're all buried there, hundreds of them, including Manono and Kikuo Kalani. So it's a really precious place. We say Vahipana in Hawaiian. It's a very sacred area.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to take that gravitas and that understanding of that conflict and remember it, because in history, if we don't learn the lessons of history, we sometimes repeat the mistakes.
We always repeat them.
That's the human condition. You know?
But so, and you know, around the mainland, you know, if you've ever visited Gettysburg or the Bighorn or anything like the Alamo, I mean, it's that people who visit them, you know, that are established historic sites. And I'm just using them as examples because no one who visits them needs to be persuaded of the value of preserving that site, right?
Exactly. And, you know, we'd like to take, you know, our nonprofit has a vision, and our vision is to take this site of war and create a place for peace.
Yeah.
A place where we can study Ho'oponopono, which is, conflict resolution. We can try to understand what aloha is in the world. You know, when I was growing up, my mother, Winona Beamer, would often say malama ko aloha before my brother and I went anywhere during the day, and we were wondering what's with the malama ko aloha all the time. You know, Mom was she wanted us to cherish our love, keep our love. Her idea was that by keeping aloha in our hearts and reflecting on its meaning in our lives, we could help the idea of aloha to grow in the world. And thanks to my mom, aloha became much more than a word to me. It became a way of being in the world.
And by extension, Keola, preserving a historic site like this does a lot more than show you where a battle was fought.
Exactly.
Right? There's the whole idea, because most battles don't end in gestures of reconciliation.
Right.
Far from it. So that's a really profound difference. That's quite a... So there's a real lesson that would go with preservation of this site.
Absolutely. And we can take that lesson and leverage it into the future. First thing we have to do is to protect and preserve the site.
Sure.
And so that's what we're working on with the wonderful partners that you mentioned, the Trust for Public Land, you know, dedicated people, intelligent human beings who understand and are helping us. So far, we've raised over 92% of our $4.25 million that we need to protect the land. We've had tremendous help from Office of Hawaiian Affairs, the State Legacy Land Funds, the Coroner's Fund for Traditional Cultures of Combined Jewish Philanthropies, a whole bunch of wonderful sponsors have gotten us 92% there, so we're so close, and we're just praying that we can make this all work.
Well, there seems to be a collective understanding on the part of these people and organizations that there is... That historic preservation is not just sort of a dry academic pursuit, that it has a very, very serious lesson to impart, an educational function.
Absolutely, yeah. And there are wonderful people in the world that want aloha to succeed. Look at our world, how fractious it is, how dangerous it is. And if we can get that message out into a wider world of compassion and love for one another...
I don't think there's anything else that could work.
Yeah, I agree.
you know, and in terms of the parlous state of the world, that if that doesn't do it, I don't know what will, but it's certainly a worthy effort. I really appreciate you taking the time, Keola. Thank you so much.
You too, Chris. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Keola Beamer is a spokesperson for Aloha Kuʻumoʻo Aina and the Trust for Public Land, which are working to preserve the ancient Kuʻumoʻo battlefield and burial grounds on Hawaii Island, south of Kona. And you can learn more about that effort on the Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14. Later in the show, we'll meet the man who helped reggae put down deep roots in the islands. But first, your quiz.
Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, ohavai.
The song A Room with a View, composed by Noel Coward, is considered one of the first hit songs written in Hawaii to be featured in a Broadway musical comedy. Coward wrote the words and music while sunbathing during a six-week trip to the islands in 1927, and the song was ultimately featured in the first act of Coward's 1928 play, This Year of Grace. Written as a lively up-tempo love song, Coward borrowed the title from a 1908 novel by E.M. Forster, which is a love story aimed at critiquing Edwardian society. About 70 years after it was written, A Room with a View was covered and recorded by a famous contemporary musician for the album 20th Century Blues, The Songs of Noel Coward. You can call for today's backyard quiz. You're wondering if you can tell us who that artist is, and you can call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Be the first caller to get it right, and you'll win an HPR T-shirt.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Nohea Gallery and Kaiser Permanente.
International Reggae Day is July 1st, and who better to talk about that than Uncle Tom Moffat? He was a friend to both Tony Johnson and Zola Burse back in the day of the original reggae Sunsplash, and he's promoted numerous reggae artists over the decades. He's also promoted the first ever reggae concert in Hawaii at Waikiki Shell with Bob Marley. So here to tell us more about what we're doing locally to celebrate reggae here in the islands is Uncle Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here. It really is.
Oh, happy to have you here. So tell us a little bit about your history with reggae.
Well, years ago, I was asked to bring this act in, and I wasn't too familiar with reggae, but I did it, and it happened. It was 1979, May 6, 1979, at the Waikiki Shell. We did an afternoon concert because we thought, well, we'll get the surfers to come from the beach and so forth. And they did. And it was Bob Marley and the Wailers. And that was my introduction to reggae. And that was Hawaii's introduction to reggae.
I can imagine why it took hold after that, with
yes.
Bob Marley of all folks.
Oh, yeah.
Now, July 1 is International Reggae Day, and it's celebrating the best of Jamaica's creativity in uniting, inspiring, and uplifting the reggae community worldwide.
Yeah, we're joining cities all over the country and in Bombay and London, all observing Reggae Day.
Now, what are we doing locally here in the islands?
Well, the Royal Hawaiian Band is going to be at the Waikiki Shell playing the Jamaican National Anthem. That's from 3 to 6. There will be yoga and all sorts of activities there. And then at night, there's going to be a screening of Toots and the Maytals. That's going to be at the Doris Duke Theater at 7 o'clock at night. Reggae soul.
Now, when people are hearing about reggae and they sort of hear about the type of music that it is, and incorporate that into some of our Hawaiian music now.
It's called Jawaiian.
It's called Jawaiian. It seems like we've sort of adopted that particular type of music and kind of incorporated it into what we play today.
It's become very popular.
It definitely has.
Hawaii meets Jamaica. Jawaiian.
Jawaiian. Hawaii meets Jamaica and combines and, you know, talks about all the same sorts of unity and celebration of what goes on in Jamaica. Now, do you have a favorite reggae artist yourself?
Well, I got to say Bob Marley.
Well, you know, you're very
first
and best.
I think as of late, UB40, they have been the biggest draw in Hawaii. Incredible.
Some of the other cities that are also celebrating, you mentioned they're international.
Uh-huh.
There are several other places, including New York, Fort Lauderdale, London, Santiago, Bombay.
Yeah.
They're all doing something great for International
Isn't that nice?
Reggae Day.
I think
Day.
It's great.
It's going to be a fantastic event and celebration,
uh-huh.
but it's not just on one day. There's also going to be, you know, opportunities for people to hear more about it and enjoy reggae and be part of this global festival, not even just July 1, but throughout the rest of July, too.
Oh, yeah. But that one special day, July 1st. Yeah.
Now, if somebody wants to know, what about the movie Reggae Soul? What is it? You know, it's if people are interested in going to Doris Duke Theater, what might they be able to see?
Well, they're going to see this great film. And Toots and the Maytals are one of the pioneers of reggae. And he was the first one to use the term reggae in a song. And there's talk of him being there, yeah? Going to do an acoustic set himself, Toots.
At
be special.
Doris Duke Theater on the 1st.
Yes, uh-huh.
Another reason that people just have to get excited and go.
Oh, yeah.
Now, reggae is such an international type of music.
Love,
and it really
peace,
does.
It really is.
It does. And there's a lot of messages that it brings that we really need to hear today. Nelson Mandela was also involved in reggae with
uh-huh.
his wife, Winnie Mandela.
She came to Jamaica and was very instrumental in elevating reggae music in Jamaica and the world.
Well, and it was 21 years ago.
Yep.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like we can recognize, not just in Jamaica, but also the inspiration even to South Africa.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Nelson Mandela
uh-huh.
being such a bastion of hope in that country. And as they transitioned from the oppressive apartheid regime, really helped to promote celebration in South Africa, but really all across the world.
Oh, yeah.
I think
yeah.
the themes of reggae really translate
uh-huh.
everywhere.
Oh, yes.
We certainly could use a lot more of it today.
Yes, we could, and it's going to happen here on July 1st.
Now, you said that the Hawaiian Band is going to actually be playing.
Royal Hawaiian Band, yes.
The Royal Hawaiian Band will be uh-huh. playing Jamaica's national anthem.
Yes, they will.
With That'll a little bit of a reggae twist.
I'm sure.
Well, they're great musicians. They can pretty much do anything
they
you throw
sure
at
can.
Them.
The Royal Hawaiian Band goes reggae in a bit.
That actually, yeah.
Before a bit.
Absolutely. That makes me want to go to the park right now and go uh-huh. watch it on July 1st. Now, this is a whole 24-hour global media event. How did you get involved in it? Has this been something you've brought
well,
pretty
Andrea
much
Davis,
every year?
Well, Andrea Davis, who's the founder and producer and artist manager of Toots, was instrumental. And I just got involved in it from the local folks who are producing Reggae Day in Hawaii.
And they're bringing some of the events like the Royal Hawaiian Band.
Yes.
And yoga in the park. That's sort of an interesting twist to,
yes,
to the whole entire episode. You know, you have a little bit of Jamaican national anthem, and then you've got a movie at night, do a little yoga during the day.
Uh-huh.
And anybody can participate. This
yes,
is open to everybody.
Yes, it is. The more the merrier.
All right. So even if you don't know yoga, I'm sure if you went there, you'd be able to find some folks who could teach you a couple of positions, and you could help celebrate the joy of reggae. If you had to describe what you feel reggae, the music, embodies, what would that be?
Love and togetherness and peace.
Well, we could certainly use a lot more of that here, I'll tell you. And it sounds like it's going to be a great event. Honolulu, along with New York, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, London, Santiago, Bombay, we're just one of the many cities joining in the annual International Reggae Day celebration on July 1st.
All right.
Thank you so much, Uncle Tom, for coming in and telling
nice
us more about
here.
It.
Always.
And for bringing it to the islands. Kingston's going to host the world in a global reggae party in a 24-hour media event. Tom Moffat's helping to coordinate the efforts. You can get more information about what we're doing here in the islands for July 1st. You can check on our website at hpr2.org.
Hi, my name is Barry Hyman. I'm an investment advisor, and I manage the Hawaii office for FIM Group. We've been proudly supporting Hawaii Public Radio since we first opened our doors in 1997. It feels good to support something that we value, and we think it's great for the community. So we want to make sure that Hawaii Public Radio thrive.
Hawaii Public Radio, celebrating partnership, building community.
How did a plan to send a greenhouse to Mars lead to SpaceX? I'm Ira Plato. Join me on Science Friday for a conversation with Elon Musk's biographer. And there's new evidence that a great-great-grandparent of a 40,000-year-old man in Romania was a Neanderthal. It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
Hawaii is a prisoner of its own geography, not only in its remoteness from everywhere else, but in the difficulty of moving goods around among the islands. That's no secret to anyone doing business here, but what do you do about it? Civil Beat's deputy editor Eric Pape looks at ways to loosen Hawaii's stranglehold on itself in his Living Hawaii column, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
This is obviously something that Hawaii has dealt with from time immemorial, and there have been various attempts to solve the problem of an island state. Why haven't any taken hold to date, do you think?
That's a good question. I think that there's a sense of independence on different islands. There's a sense of unique spaces. A lot of that has to do with history and culture. A lot of it is healthy and has allowed people maybe to survive and at times thrive. There's a resistance sometimes to economic solutions to what are ultimately economic problems, at least now. Things that may not have been such a problem at some other times, I think are now. I've been focusing in the Living Hawaii series on the high cost of living in Hawaii. And basically, if you want to bring down the cost of living on the neighbor islands, you need to find ways to connect them economically. That doesn't mean to make them subservient to Oahu, and that doesn't mean it shouldn't be done. With the people on the different islands who are being connected better by what would be good government, it shouldn't be a barrier to them having decisions and choices. But on the other hand, it is something maybe that one of the biggest things that could help people's incomes to increase, and it could create jobs.
Something like the Super Ferry, which was tried and went bankrupt. And you speak of the independent ethos of different islands. The Super Ferry was turned away from the island of Kauai. So, there's a resistance to things like that.
There is a resistance, and there's especially a resistance when it's done poorly, when it doesn't follow the rules, when there's not a sense of inviting people into the discussion and making sure that, that what's being done is what people want.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are looking at different islands having their different economies and having a lack of competition on the islands that helps to drive prices up, you need to generate more competition. You need to generate more opportunity. So allowing people to be able to travel between islands, to see families and to meet people, to network, to find ways to do business together, can generate a lot more economic activity. And that economic activity can help overcome the very serious problem on some of the islands around salaries. Salaries have not gone up in real terms in the islands for the middle class for decades. And we do need solutions. A ferry system is not the only one possible, but it is certainly a good one. It's used all over the world. It's used in other parts of the United States. It's used on oceans. And a different version of a ferry system is one of the solutions that should really be considered.
Another that you consider in your piece is discounted airfares, which the airlines have discounted needing to do, you know? They're not...
That's very true. There is... there are discounts all the time at airlines, right? But we know that the overall prices have gone up. And we know that the other economic pressures on people have gotten worse. So having discounts that actually allow more people, a larger number of people who live in the islands to get between islands, would have a very similar effect. And there are other ways to do it, too. I think we need to consider all of them. And I think it's one of the ways to respond to the cost of living crisis in the state.
Well, let's hope something breaks the logjam, Eric. Thanks very much for talking with us.
I'm Bob Garfield. On this week's On the Media, we consider the possibility of a digital dark age.
Of course, I worry about them, but they have to worry about themselves because it's not going to be my problem. It will, however, be theirs.
What happens to humanity when we're cut off from our digital history? Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
This afternoon at 5, following Studio 360.
And you're back with the conversation. On Fridays at this time, we check in with our news director, Bill Dorman, about what's been worked on down in his lair. And, Bill, we've got a couple of Supreme Court decisions hovering over everything the last couple of days, don't we?
Yeah, good morning, Chris. We really do, you know. And in both of these cases, you know, the Affordable Care Act and same-sex marriage, people may look at this on the surface and say, well, in Hawaii, this doesn't really have that much of an impact because the state led the way in a lot of ways in terms of Affordable Care Act, insurance coverage, and also in terms of same-sex marriage. And yet, there are ripples, and there are sort of stories underneath the surface that very much are local and very much apply to our community here. And so we're going to be taking a look. I can't tell you exactly how we're going to be doing that or who's going to be doing that, but I tell you that's an area we'll be looking at.
Well, there's always, you know, Supreme Court decisions are never explainable in a couple of lines, are they?
It's true.
They resonate in different ways, and it takes weeks to figure them out.
You know, and that's one of the things you got to love about public radio on good days of establishing some of that context, some of that background, and giving listeners a little bit more to chew on. So we'll be doing that. We also have another topic in that area. You know, renewable energy is always a headline, and seemingly every week there's some aspect of that. On Kauai, when we talk about renewable energy, statewide, usual suspects, you know, solar, wind, geothermal, other approaches under investigation, experimentation, we forget about a lot of times really the first renewable energy source, which is hydroelectric power, water.
Yeah.
And on Kauai in particular, they've been doing some things that are really perhaps lessons for the rest of the state, things that other islands could learn from. Scott Jarman, our contributing reporter up on Kauai, is taking a closer look at some of how that is going on and, some things that are happening a little bit under the surface that may have implications statewide. So that'll be an interesting.
Well, since Kauai gets record rainfall, it's a good place to remember that of the renewable nature of that particular resource, right?
Exactly. And, you know, so often when we look back at our own history, at Hawaii's own history, there are lessons there of things that people did at one time that that somehow we've gotten away from for one reason or another. And, you know, again, sometimes people forget, you know, back in the 1800s and earlier in some ways in terms of use of, again, water as power. At any rate, there's a lot to look at in that.
We have trouble sometimes remembering that people did know what they were doing back in earlier centuries, right?
Yes, it's true. It's true. And learning from history and learning from some of the bigger stories in terms of those national stories with local implications as well. So it'll be another busy week.
Sounds like it. Well, Bill, we'll look for those stories on the news. Thanks very much.
You bet. Thanks, Chris.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Supply, announcing Radiance Reflective Roof Shingles, solar reflective shingles designed and made for Hawaii to reflect the heat and help keep homes cool. Learn more at radianceroof.com.
And on Friday, we read your letters and emails. Following my Tuesday interview with author, political scientist, and social critic Robert Putnam, we got this.
Dear Conversation, I found Robert Putnam's choice of words offensive. Most working families are single-parent parent households, wrong side of the tracks, no longer racially segregated. Though I have not read his book, I don't think solutions will come from reminiscing nostalgically on how things were. We need to figure out how to adapt to a new way of learning and teaching to achieve this so-called American dream. Perhaps we must redefine what is the American dream. America idolizes money, fame, and plastic beauty. It's no wonder the I got mine and not in my backyard attitude has crept into our core values. Sincerely, Joni McGinnis.
And in response to our Thursday interview about the DOE's Strive High program, we got this. Aloha, Beth Ann and Chris. I was surprised to hear your interview with a Waiakea teacher regarding smarter balanced assessments without any opportunity for a balanced discussion. Your conversation only featured one teacher's view in opposition and her understanding what students experience. It would have better served Chris and your listeners to have information and context to what smarter balanced is. The new assessments replaces the former Hawaii State reading and mathematics assessments and smarter balanced assessments in reading and math measures not only what students know, but also how well they can apply their knowledge in real-world situations. It's expected that the change to the new test and standards will result in a drop in scores as compared with previous years. Lower test scores do not mean students are performing any worse, because these are newer, higher expectations for student learning. Results from this year are a new starting point. In other words, it is reasonable to compare 2015 scores with next year's scores, same assessment, but not with last year's HSA scores. I hope in the future you will consider seeking more information. I'm certainly happy to provide that for you, and I encourage you, at the very least, to visit hawaiipublicschools.org. Mahalo, Donalyn Dela Cruz, Director, Communications and Community Affairs Office, Hawaii State Department of Education.
Thanks for the letters. Our new talkback line is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
The Affordable Care Act of 2010 has been on shaky ground since the beginning, but yesterday's Supreme Court decision likely means it's here to stay. And as with any of the high court's decisions, some interpretation and explanation after the fact are called for. So we're asking Attorney Anderson Meyer to help us sort it all out. Good morning, Anderson. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's get to the specific decision that was made and talk about the case before the court and what it actually addressed.
Sure. The case the Supreme Court handed down yesterday stemmed from the Affordable Care Act, and specifically a gentleman named David King, who's a 64-year-old Vietnam veteran living in Virginia, who didn't want to have to pay for his health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And under the Affordable Care Act, there is an individual mandate, so he was required to have health insurance. The insurance that was available to him was more than 8% of his income, so he would have been excluded from having to purchase his own, but for the tax subsidies. And the tax subsidies put it down to an amount where he was required to purchase it, and he didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
So he and I think it was three other plaintiffs sued. Basically, their suit was about the IRS and the IRS's interpretation of the Affordable Care Act and these tax subsidies.
Actually went directly to the federal funding for each state.
That's right. What was being argued over in this case was whether the IRS's application of the tax subsidies was appropriate under the Act. And specifically, the Affordable Care Act says that the tax subsidies apply to the costs to help defray the cost of health insurance for people who get their insurance through an exchange established by the state. Now, in Virginia, they didn't establish their own healthcare exchange.
Yeah.
What they did is they said, we're not going to do that. And there's a provision in the Affordable Care Act that says that if a state does not establish their own exchange, the Secretary of Health and Human Services shall establish such exchange, and that's the language in the statute.
Mm-hmm.
They'll establish such exchange for the state. So what the petitioners in the King v. Burwell case said was, listen, Virginia doesn't have a state-established exchange because Virginia didn't establish its own. Therefore, these tax subsidies shouldn't apply to me. So they sued. And they said the IRS regulation is contrary to the Affordable Care Act, and the tax subsidy should only apply to those states that establish their own exchanges.
Had that suit succeeded, Anderson, it would have killed the ACA.
Well, that's the theory, and that's certainly what the majority of the Supreme Court said yesterday.
The death spiral.
Exactly. The phrase that the majority used in their opinion, which was authored by the Chief Justice Roberts, they started out the opinion talking basically about the economics of healthcare insurance and the problems, and this is the economic death spiral that he talks about in the opening sections of the opinion, that this death spiral of adverse selection that we've seen in years past in health insurance was one of the reasons that the Affordable Care Act was enacted in the first place, to avoid that problem, that death spiral phrase that he uses. And so that's the reason for the third major aspect of the Affordable Care Act, the subsidies. We have three, just to update your listeners on what the Affordable Care Act is, there are three basic prongs to it. One is that the non-discrimination aspect, that people can't be turned away for pre-existing conditions.
Right.
The second is the individual mandate, that everybody has to buy their insurance.
Doesn't work unless everybody takes part.
Exactly right. And that's the adverse selection piece. If the young, healthy people don't buy in, and
yeah,
you just have the older, sicker people buying in, the economics don't
work. Crashes.
Right. So everybody has to have insurance. That's the individual mandate. And in order to make that work, we have the third prong, the subsidies, where there are tax credits if your income is between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty level. And so it's that third prong, the subsidies piece, that was the focus of this litigation.
And that has now been shored up by the Supreme Court, which has elected to interpret it in terms of law rather than in terms of individual government or state administrations.
Exactly.
Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. What often happens is if you have a term in a statute that the court or someone else says is ambiguous, mm-hmm, which is what happened here with the phrase.
Then who resolves the ambiguity?
Exactly. So the phrase of an exchange established by the state was the ambiguous issue here. And often what will happen is if you have a statutory term or phrase that's ambiguous, when there's a government agency, here the IRS, that is responsible for enforcing that provision of the law,
they resolve it.
They will interpret it. And the courts, under a case called Chevron from years ago, there's a Chevron deference standard where the courts will say, listen, if this is ambiguous and if there's a government agency that has the job of enforcing this, we're going to defer. Exactly. Yeah. We're going to defer to that agency. And that's what the Fourth Circuit did here. The Fourth Circuit said, yes, there's an ambiguous term, but the IRS has interpreted this as, listen, we're going to apply these tax subsidies to any exchange, irrespective of whether it was established by a state or the federal government. That's the Chevron deference, defer to the agency. The Supreme Court took another tack. They looked at this and they said, okay, typically we would say defer to the agency if there's an ambiguous term or phrase in the statute. But in this case, and not just this case, in cases where there's an extraordinary circumstance, which is what they said was at issue here, the court will not defer to the agency. So what the Supreme Court did here in agreeing that it doesn't matter who established the exchange, whether it's a state or the federal exchange, the subsidies will apply. That's the end result here. But the Supreme Court did not defer to the IRS interpretation. They interpreted the language of the statute and, as a matter of law, said that whether it's a state established or a federal established exchange, the subsidies apply.
So that's what that kind of locked it in ways that it wouldn't if it had been subject to change by future administrative bodies.
Absolutely, and that's an excellent point, is when the Chevron deference standard applies, you're looking to the agency and the agency's interpretation, and agency's interpretations may and do change.
Known to change.
Exactly. They'll change or can change depending on the administration that's in office. So by taking it outside of the agency interpretation here, and with the majority opinion in King v. Burwell yesterday saying that as a matter of law, this is how it works, it's taken it out of the political arena. And so we're not looking at something that may just change again with another administration. This is – it's much more –
That's what really makes it a historic decision.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Anderson.
Thank
very
you.
Much. Attorney Anderson Meyer practices in areas of commercial litigation, personal injury defense, insurance defense, health care, medical malpractice defense, legal malpractice, and constitutional and civil rights litigation. He's lectured on appellate advocacy at the William S. Richardson School of Law, his alma mater, and you can learn more about him on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
I'm Michelle Dalton from Hilo's performance poetry group Spirit and Flesh here on the Big Island. You're tuned into HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
In this morning's Backyard Quiz, we focused on the song A Room with a View by Noel Coward. The song is considered one of the first pieces of music written in Hawaii to be featured in a Broadway musical comedy, and Coward wrote both the words and music while sunbathing during a 6-week-long trip to the islands in 1927. The song was ultimately featured in the first act of Coward's 1928 play, This Year of Grace. Written as a lively, bubbly, and up-tempo love song, Coward borrowed the title from a 1908 novel by E.M. Forster, which is a love story aimed at critiquing Edwardian society. Roughly 70 years after the song was written, A Room with a View was covered and recorded by a famous contemporary musician for the album 20th Century Blues, the songs of Noel Coward. For today's Backyard Quiz, we were wondering if you can tell us who that artist is. The correct answer is Sir Paul McCartney. It's 8:50. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, whose charitable foundation awards donations, containers, and in-kind services in Hawaii and around the Pacific Basin. Matson.com/foundation.
Tiny, stinging red fire ants are invading Hawaii. They can bite and then leave a welt that can last for weeks. But how did they get here and where are they hiding? And why should we worry about it? Here with an update on the latest is Aaron Bishop of the Oahu Invasive Species Committee. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to see that you have a very closed vial of dead invasive fire ants over there and that it's radio. Tell me, fire ants, how did they get here and why should I be worried?
Well, little fire ants are actually not the typical fire ants that people think of when you're in Hawaii. Folks in Hawaii, most everyone has had issues with ants. You have them in your home, in your yard. Little fire ants are very different, though. They're actually a newer species to the islands, and they were first detected in 1999 on the Big Island in the Puna District. And since then, they have spread up the Windward Coast on the Big Island and then even hitchhiked over to Kailua Kona on the west side. They are making their way across the islands in Hawaii, and now all of the islands except for Molokai have had detections of little fire ants. The good news is that they are not established on all the islands throughout the state. Big Island does have an established population that will likely never be able to get rid of, but on the other islands, they are new, incipient infestations, and if we catch them early, we're able to get rid of them.
Now, it takes three things to make a species invasive and to be considered not appropriate for here. Not every foreign species that has come here is considered a problem. What are those three things?
Correct. Not all non-native species are considered invasive. For a plant or an animal to be considered invasive, they have to have negative impacts on the environment, the economy, and our health.
So it's like that triad. I mean, plumeria trees didn't come locally from Hawaii, but they're here. We like them. They smell good. And they're not considered invasive.
Correct. Things like plumeria trees and many of the canoe plants that the early Polynesian settlers brought over are not native to Hawaii, but they aren't invasive. So you don't see plumeria trees or coconut trees invading our forests, causing impacts on our watersheds, therefore causing impacts on our economy and our health.
But we do see these little invasive red fire ants actually causing some troubles, and not just to humans, but to pets, too.
Correct. Little fire ants have a very painful sting, and they not only sting us, but they also attack animals. And people that live on the Big Island and infested areas are seeing their pets, their cats and dogs, especially those that spend time outside. They are getting repeatedly stung in their eyes by little fire ants that are caught in their fur. After these repeated stings, they start to get infections, and you see clouded corneas in these pets, and this blindness is irreversible. So it's very painful for pets, and it's also very painful for the humans that live in the area.
And you mentioned it's not just one ant that comes to bite you. It's like 20 of them.
Right.
They bring a little army to feed on you.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm starting to itch.
Yeah, it does make you itch. Little fire ants aren't necessarily an aggressive ant. They don't attack people for no reason. When you get stung.
Well, what do they want from me? I'm innocent.
Yeah. When you get stung, it's because they are falling out of the trees. And this is one of the things that make little fire ant one of the worst invasive pests in the entire world. They not only nest on the ground, but they nest up in the trees. And even for an arboreal ant that lives in the trees, they don't hang on very well. So we have these great trade wind days. On those days, it's going to be raining ants. So when you get stung by a little fire ant, it's not just one. You're going to get 15 or 20 stings because they're falling in your hair, on your neck. They get stuck in your collar. And it really makes just being outside nearly impossible. You just don't want to spend any time outside if you get stung every day.
Starting to itch. Okay. Now there's a plan, and there's a way you can look to detect them. Tell me quickly about this popsicle stick, peanut butter, freezer, mail them to the Department of Health plan.
Right. A lot of people have heard about the peanut butter chopstick test. The peanut butter chopstick test is very simple. We encourage everyone that lives in Hawaii to test your property at least once a year. This means that if we find them early, we can get rid of the ants. To do the peanut butter chopstick test, you place some peanut butter on chopsticks, place them around your property, and wait 45 minutes. If you have ants, you place them in Ziploc bags, put them in the freezer so we're not mailing live ants across the island.
The post office would love that.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you actually mail it to your local Hawaii Department of Agriculture office.
And there's some information on the website about for all the islands where they can mail those. And if somebody wanted to get more information, where can they go?
You can go to several places. You can go to lfahawaii.org. You can go to littlefireants.com. You can also visit hdoa.hawaii.gov. That's Department of Agriculture's website.
And also, I was looking at your website, oahuisc.org, the Oahu Invasive Species Committee. All right. Well,
correct.
You've started to make me itch. Thanks. Thanks for bringing a little sample. And if you want to take a look, you can head to our Facebook page and you'll be able to see a picture of these little pesty ants. Fire ants are everyone's responsibility. If you want to know more on how to prevent further infestation, you can find out this Saturday, 11:45, Hawaii State Library. Free test kits will be distributed to the public. Thank you, Aaron Bishop from the Invasive Species Committee, sharing with us information on all sorts of these little fire ants and other invasive pests. You can find out more on their website. And you can check out ours if you want to start itching at hpr2.org.
And that's it for this week. I want to thank Kathy Kozak, who will be with us for another week sitting in. But coming up next week, Elizabeth Riley, president of Hawaii Kai Hui, working to protect the urban grow boundaries of the east and saving the Kaiwi coast.
Plus a pop art market at the Hawaii State Art Museum where you can find unique, one-of-a-kind gifts for the whole family. And also an update on the fundraising efforts to help the people of Nepal.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number at 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get other past shows, or links to more information, check out the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Koslovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Taylor Rice is our production assistant. Jessica Hanau is our intern.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMillo. I'm Kathy Kozak.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.